So we're talking handlebars. I might as well say bike, I suppose, hadn't I? Guiding this bike through what could have been troubled waters, but now seems to be, I don't know, how to ride a bike through troubled waters.
I was about to say, I don't. If you're taking your bike through water, you've probably gone wrong.
Yeah, you're taking a wrong turn in somewhere, yeah.
It's a fantastic five for Reading. They make it five wins on the spin in the championship. As we start to really ask, what is this side capable of? We close the gap on the top of the championship and we're 7 points clear of those teams in the playoff chasing pack. This week it was a 2-1 win over Bristol City. But just as we're starting to get all nice and comfortable, takeover rumours resurface. We will tackle both the matters on the pitch and off the pitch in this week's Tarlest End podcast, the 108th episode of this show. Thank you very much for joining us this week. My name is Dan Wimbush, editor of thetarlestend.com, and I'd like to be joined this week by Mr. Dave Handbags Harris, who has recovered from his illness and joins us this week. Dave, hello.
Good evening.
Are you feeling better now?
I am, yeah. Last week, very much sounded more like Sean Dyche than Sean Dyche himself.
Excellent. Well, great to have you with us. No Johnny this week. He's got the week off, and no Westy. Westy struggles to do evenings these days, so it's just the two of us, Dave. Nice.
Intimate.
We can make it if we try.
Absolutely.
Just the two of us, you and I. Anyway, with that karaoke-esque intro out of the way, as I said, we've got lots to talk about, including that win over Bristol City. They made it five in a row. Takeover rumours, lots of bits and pieces in the mailbag as usual. You guys have been filling it, so thank you very much indeed. And a very quick crowdfunding plug as well. We've got a couple of people who have dipped into their pockets to help us this week. So I'd like to give a shout out to Ewan Cunningham and Matt. I can't pronounce his second name. How do we say we were going to pronounce this, Dave?
Well, I reckon it's German, so I'm going with Neudeg.
So Matt Neudeg. Again, apologies if I've butchered your name, but this is an unprofessional joke of a podcast, and that is the least you should expect. But in all seriousness, thank you very, very much indeed to the both of you and to everyone who has joined in on the Patreon campaign. It's patreon.com/thetarlestend. That's patreon.com/thetarlestend. Doesn't have to be a little, can be a lot if you want to, but every little bit helps. I've purchased a couple of microphones this week, which should hopefully arrive in the next couple of weeks, so going to give those a try out, see if they're any better than what we've got at the moment. So that is the sort of thing that your money goes towards. So thank you very much indeed. That is at patreon.com/thetarlestend. But anyway, enough of that. Let's move on to the recap.
View from the Tarlestend.
Recapping this week's championship action.
So Dave, Reading 2, Bristol City 1. As mentioned several times already, five wins on the spin. But for me, personally, I thought this was the hardest challenge we've had. We did build it up as much on last week's show, myself and Johnny, but sure enough, Bristol City really did give Reading a scare. And in the end, they were sort of hanging on a bit, but overall, Reading worthy of the 3 points?
Just about, I think. I mean, Bristol City, they were never going to sit and lie down, were they? Particularly at 2-0 down at half-time. It's very similar to the Forest and Burton games insofar as that, you know, both sides... when you're losing at half time, you kind of open up and you put the pressure on the opponent, and that's what happened. I'm not convinced that it's going to work, second half performances are going to work all the time for us. I think we're riding a little bit of the crest of a wave and getting a little bit lucky at times. You know, you look back to the Huddersfield game; they had a couple of very, very presentable chances.
The Forest one as well.
Forest had some very, very presentable chances. Burton had a couple of presentable chances. And so did Bristol City have some presentable chances. Now, at the moment, as I say, those sides are actually missing those chances, which is, you know, great for us. But eventually, I think we're going to come a cropper.
Yeah,
at some point, if that continues.
And credit to Alio Hubsey as well, who is in the form of his Reading life.
Yes, absolutely. You know, ultimately, an opposition side have got to beat the keeper.
Indeed.
He's part of the... part of the armoury.
Well, you get the one thing that's been pleasing recently is the way that Reading have been able to get dominance early in games. You look at Wigan going 2-0 up in, 6 minutes? Against Burton as well, they've got a couple in short space of time. And this week as well, Dominic Samuel winning an early penalty. Now, this was a bit of a controversial one, Dave. I know that Johnny has been voicing his concerns about it. Lee Johnson, the Bristol City manager in particular, is fuming at this decision. He went on to say the penalty was given by someone who's probably not played football an awful lot before. It was two players running for the ball. The striker's legs get tangled up as he cuts across the defender and falls over. No complaints, yet it's a penalty. How did you sit? Because you sit in roughly this. Were you in the East Stand this week?
No, I wasn't in the East Stand this week. I was in my usual area of the Eamon Dolan Stand. I was just to the right of goal, about three or four rows up, and had a completely unimpeded view of said incident. It's a penalty.
Yeah,
it's a penalty. The guy has Samuel has outpaced the defender, got in front of the defender. The defender has carelessly tapped the trailing foot of Dominic Samuel, which has sent that foot into the back of or the side of the planted foot, as it were. And when that happens, you lose momentum in the bottom half of the body. Now, the top half momentum carries on, and what happens? Player falls over. It's a trip.
You're a referee, would you have given that?
I would have given it, absolutely, 100%. Every single time, if I see that, I would have given it. Now, I have an advantage as a Sunday league referee or Saturday morning referee in that usually you can hear the contact as well, and you can tell if it's a boot on boot or if it's a different sound. So I have that advantage, and you are not entirely convinced that a referee would necessarily have that advantage with 18,000 people blaring their voices down onto the pitch. But based on the evidence that I saw, my first instinct was penalty, and I was actually up and shouting for it as soon as I saw it, and was about to actually start berating the referee for not giving it when the linesman raised his flag.
You voicing displeasure at a referee decision, Dave? Never heard of it.
Oh, well, yeah, absolutely, of course. So, for me, absolutely nailed on penalty, and I really don't know what Lee Johnson's getting himself into.
Well, I had a bad view of it sitting in Y25, so kind of almost the backside view of it. My initial reaction was, he's gone down very easy there. I can't see him giving it. And initially, I don't think the referee did give it. I think it was his assistant that sort of made the decision.
Yeah, and this is one of the things that you know, people just... at risk of boxing everybody into one sort of generic supporter, but you get the supporter who says he's gone down very easy. But if a player is running at full pelt and he gets a tap on his ankle, it's very, very difficult for that player to stay on his feet. Now, there's a reason why in rugby, say you get a winger or a fullback or any player, for example, who is a fairly nippy player, and they get the ball and they got a whole half to run into, and they've got a similarly nippy player trying to catch them, you know, before they reach the try line. There's a reason why they call that the tackle that I'm referring to in rugby the tap tackle, because it is literally a tap on the ankle that sends the trailing foot into the back of or the side of the planted foot to bring that man down. It's only a tap. It's not a particularly heavy touch. That player is not going to stay on his feet, or it's unlikely to stay on his feet. And this is what's happened with Dominic Samuel. Now, Lee Johnson could turn around and say, two players running for the ball, striker's legs get tangled up as he cuts across the defender. Well, the law states that a referee has to assess whether the challenge is careless, reckless, or using excessive force. Careless, this clearly comes under careless as far as I'm concerned, because the defender has been careless in not avoiding contact. The attacker has overtaken the defender. He's quicker than the defender, and of course, when you're in a straight running race for the ball, you're going to take the direct path, and then invariably that means the striker is going to, once he's in front of the defender, he's going to cut across the path of the defender because he's got a clear path.
Do you think he was looking for it? Because we also had this incident a couple of weeks ago against Burton as well, where he went over a couple of times in the box, neither given on that occasion.
Well, the second one that I'm thinking of with Burton, he was clearly pushed over. I don't know what Keith Stroud or the assistant, I don't know why they haven't given that. It was a push. He should have had I don't know whether it was in the box or out of the box, but if it was in the box, then they should have given a penalty. This one, was he looking for it? No, I think he was just making a genuine straight race for the ball and goes over as a result of the tap. And you can see, you know, it was what I would call a natural fall, insofar as the arms weren't flailing up in the air in a sort of exaggerated dive, as it were. It was the arms are, I haven't seen it for a couple of days, but if I remember right, the arms are just kind of sort of braced to break the fall, and as he lands, he kind of swivels his body around to look at the referee. Now, Johnson says that there's no complaint. You can actually tell by Samuel's reaction in the fall that he's turning around to look at the referee. you know, almost incredulous that he's actually been brought down. He can't actually believe that he's been brought down. So I don't think he was actually looking for it. I think it's just an unfortunate event for the defender, but yeah. at the same time,
it's
careless.
And it's something that Dom Samuel gives you up front. That pace does worry defenders. We've said it all season when we were talking about they need to get a new striker and, you know, they need to get someone with the pace to open up that option. Reading's ninth championship penalty of the season. That was according to StatBank. I've lost complete count. I've seen a couple of different figures, but I think nine is right. If it is right, I don't care if it's not right. If even it's one low, it's a phenomenal amount of penalties that Reading have been given this season.
That comes from pressure.
It does. And Gareth McCleary steps up and unfortunately misses again, but thankfully pops home the rebound.
Again. Just like he did at Barnsley.
Yeah, I don't think he'll be on penalties next week somehow.
No, I don't think so. And I don't think Danny Williams will be either. I'd say that's the third penalty that we've missed and managed to score the rebound. He's missed 2 of 5. So, it's a 60% conversion rate, but at the same time, he's also plonked in the rebound. He's got lucky a little bit so far, but no, as I say, you're missing 2 of 5, then, you know, the rule of thumb is that 7 out of 10 penalties are scored, and he's not on target for that, is he?
No. If only we'd had him in 95 at Wembley to pop home a rebound for a penalty.
Quite.
Indeed. Anyway, let's not go there. So Reading go 1-0 up, all great, and they continue to push. They do really well. And then we get what is possibly one of the best goals you will see, technically, at the Medeski Stadium ever. Ball goes out to McCleary, plays a lovely little chip ball to Chris Gunter, who hits it first time, back across the box, finds the boot of Roy Behrens, and it slams into the back of the net. It's one of those things where you almost just think, have I just been watching a game of FIFA? Because it was that good. There was kind of a bit of a hush fest because people couldn't believe it.
Yeah, it's up there with the Nick Blackman goal at Hull last season.
Yeah.
Which is almost unbelievably good. Yeah, it was exceptional goal. Extremely well executed. I've seen plenty of response to that from both sides. Shall we say, suggesting whether or not Chris Gunter actually meant the pass. Well, clearly he meant to put it into an area, which is, you know, ultimately what you do as a wide player. You put the ball into an area and it's up to the strikers or the attackers to actually attack that ball. As it is, he's put it virtually onto a sixpence for Roy Behrens, who's you know, his technical ability is unquestioned. Excellent goal.
I thought overall it was just a fantastic first half performance. They had a real swagger about it. You really got the impression looking at it, this is a team that knows what they're doing. They know what their roles are. They've got a plan. And they just look so much more comfortable than some of those early season games where you're thinking, it's not quite clicking. But this was just a team, as I said, swagger is the word that comes to mind.
At the moment, yes. Let's not get too carried away.
The first half, anyway.
We're less than halfway through the season and we're still waiting for that period of time when opposition actually sort of, shall we say, find us out, as it were, which every club goes through, and it's up to us to work out how to actually counteract that. But yeah, at the moment, it's really pleasing to watch, and we're actually looking significantly more potent.
Well, you talk about finding us out, and to a small extent, Bristol City did that in the second half because they very much had the better of that second period. They took quite a while, you know, they only scored a goal, 5 minutes from the end from O'Neill, but they were putting Reading under a lot of pressure. And the person I picked out in the further reading column that you can go check out on thetarlesden.com at the moment was Roy Behrens. Now, we just talked about how fantastic a goal it was, but I thought that his second half performance was really poor and he really drifted out of that game. And when I actually went to look at the stats behind it, you look at his stats, second half passing success rate, 43%. Now that's something you would not even expect from a keeper that's just kicking it long all the time, yet alone a player who's given a central role sort of in the tip of a midfield attack. He didn't have a lot of success shooting or creating chances either and was subbed off not too long from the end. What have you made of him in that position? Is he a good enough fill-in for John Swift?
I think when we're on the front foot, he's very good there. I don't think he's as good as John Swift, but he's pretty much as good as we're going to get, I think. He's a creative player. He's a get them the ball down to his feet type of player. And he's got that little bit of creativity about him that suggests that he could be relatively decent there. But when, you know, when a team is and the opposition are really pushing forward like Bristol City were on the second half in the second half on Saturday, he's not the man that you want in that midfield three. Now, yes, he's the advanced one of the three, but I just want a little bit more solidity. That midfield three is there to not just provide creativity, but also to protect the back line. You're losing a third of that defensive solidity with him if you're on the defensive.
And I was going to say, especially with Dom Samuel in the team, who doesn't offer that same amount of defensive cover that Jan Kermigant does. You really need, like you say, everyone needs to pitch in. And exactly. There was just a little bit too much.
If Jan Kermigant was up there, I think we could have counteracted it. You know, yeah. Maybe that would have brought a better performance out of Behrens by having a different player up there. You know, we won't know for the time being until Kermigant returns to the side and Behrens plays in the centre. But yeah, certainly with Dom Samuel up there, again, yeah, you're losing a significant level of defensive ability there.
Yeah, and not to pick on Dom Samuel at all. Again, you know, two games so far, he scored one and he's set up another. So in terms of end product, fantastic. But again, digging into those stats in that further reading column, Dom Samuel's inability to really win balls in the air, I think, could be a problem going down. Because this week, 2 out of 13 headers won. And I noticed when Bristol City started closing down Al-Habsi and the defenders a bit more, not giving them that easy pass, and they were having to kick it long. You could tell that reluctance from Al-Habsi. He didn't really want to kick it towards Samuel. He was trying to go wide. Because every time it went to the centre, Samuel was losing the ball and it was coming straight back.
Yeah.
Which isn't a problem when you're on the front foot and you're playing nice attacking possession football and you've got a real stranglehold on the game. But when you are under the cosh and you haven't got that out ball, you know, it's like you say, the opposition figures you out. And that's not something you can level at Jan Kermigant, because Jan Kermigant does a very good job. I think his success rate in duels is something around 60%.
60%, yeah, around that.
Whereas if you look at Dom Samuel, just on the basis of that, I think he won none out of two the week before. So that's 2 out of 15. So, you know, we're looking at a very, 5-10% sort of ratio. So is that a worry? Is that possibly one of the reasons why Championship managers like Brian McDermott, Steve Clarke, Nigel Atkins haven't given Samuel a run?
I think the propensity for player or for managers to play a forward player on his own has hindered Samuel. All right, last season with McDermott we saw a front two at times, particularly with Hal Robson Kanu and obviously Kermigant and Vidra. Samuel was also out on loan during that period of time, so wasn't actually here to actually be part of the first team.
But they have had the chance to recall him. I remember Brian McDermott specifically saying, we're not going to get him back. We're going to keep him out on loan.
But there's no point with Samuel the way he was at the time, and this, to a degree showing now, you're going to bring him back, give him a two-game chance, and then find out that he's not quite good enough, and then go, you know, resort to type. It's not good for Dom Samuel. Samuel was getting game time at Gillingham, you know, week in, week out. He wasn't scoring a prolific amount, but then Gillingham weren't winning a huge number of games either. But he was getting game time. He was getting experience. It's not necessarily something that we could necessarily guarantee last season. So I think it was the right decision, certainly for McDermott, to keep him out on loan. And perhaps allow him that opportunity to develop in a division below.
What's your gut feeling there? You've been watching Reading for well over 20 years now and seen a lot of players come and go. You know, is this the player that's going to develop a la Shane Long, or is this the player that's going to develop a la Neville Roach, or someone in the middle?
I think it's at the moment it's definitely in the middle. He's a fox in the box type striker. The goal that he scored against Burton was pretty much Samuel all over, I think. His pace is exceptional. It's about using that pace. He's got better pace than certainly a lot of strikers that we've had at this club. He's certainly up there in the top 25%, I would say, of strikers in terms of raw speed. But it's the general ability and capability of being able to overcome Championship defenders, I think, might be his downfall. So certainly on Saturday, I think he had one chance to get a shot away in the second half, which was blocked.
Yeah, it's that physical side of the game that you do worry. And Johnny pointed this out last week. I mean, for a guy who's about 6'2", it's amazing how little sort of strength he's got. And I mean, hopefully that might come.
He's very slim. He's very slight, and I say he's in his early 20s now, and he should have developed to the absolute maximum that he will do pretty much. It's funny, we saw a similar sort of player in Carlos Saba, who again was 6'2", but won very little in the air. Which, you know, for, as I say, you think for a player of that size, but then, you know, if they're slim and slight and more a quick, speedy, nippy type player, then, you know, and their game isn't suited to necessarily, or their physique isn't suited to winning balls in the air, then you need to counteract that. Now, I don't think necessarily we play quite the game that Dominic Samuel would necessarily like, which would be, you know, getting the ball ideally into those channels, into channels and in behind, and getting him running and turning a defence. We saw more of it against Burton. They played a much higher line than Bristol City. City were a bit more savvy. They played a deeper line and didn't allow them to get turned by balls in behind them.
You talk about physical presence, though. Certainly an accusation you can't say that someone like Paul McShane didn't have on Saturday. I thought it was just a fantastic, gutsy performance from him. Not taking anything away from Liam Moore or Tyler Blackett, who I both thought, again, were good. But McShane in particular, some of those blocks in the second period. You can see exactly why Stam has a player like him in the team. Because as much as you love the technical prowess of someone like a Moore, there's still that role for your kind of more old-fashioned centre-half.
Yeah, absolutely. I think he's typical 110% player. It just throwing himself everything, getting himself in the way. I mean, all three of them, they had their work cut out with Tammy Abraham, who was exceptional, I thought, with the exception of his finishing touch. So to actually come away, all right, we didn't keep a clean sheet. And funnily enough, the one time that we didn't have anybody busting a gut to get out to a shot was the one time that City scored. I think there was one block after about 83, 84 minutes, a couple of minutes before City scored. I think it was McShane that made
it.
That was, I thought, you know, from where I was, nailed on. Yeah, this is going in. This is my 3 points in the prediction league. it was absolutely superb. And that's one of the things in the first half on Saturday, being closer to the play where I was behind the goal. You do get to see the physical prowess of players and the physical attributes of their game a hell of a lot more. And it's something that you don't necessarily, my previous vantage point at the top of Y25, you didn't necessarily appreciate. It's moving around the stadium has certainly given me a different perspective on the game.
I think I might be following you into the Eamon Dolan next season. I think my time in Y25 is coming to an end.
Come and join me.
I will come and join you over there.
Absolutely.
We'll do. Anyway, enough of that. Yap Stam's view on the game. He said afterwards that we were playing the ball back to Ali a bit too much, which allowed them to put us under more and more pressure, when sometimes you need to go forward to defend even better. Attack is often the best form of defence. And if you concede one near the end, it's always going to be a bit nervy in the last minutes, but I'm very happy with how we performed defensively.
I tend to agree with that. I thought we were, you know, generally with the City attack, you know, they did have some good chances, but at the same time, against a good attack, I think we controlled what happened pretty well. At 2-1, 2 minutes after they scored, they had a couple of another sort of 60-90 seconds worth of pressure, and then suddenly we get the ball and just win a free kick, slow the game down, and that's game management, and that's really, really good as far as I'm concerned.
What did you make of Yaku Mate's introduction? He scored a couple in the week with under-23s in their European adventure against Bilbao. Came on, obviously, there's a growing sort of hype behind him. I noticed, as, I don't know about hype, but excitement's probably a better word.
Yeah, I think, was it Charles Watts said that whenever Stam talks about him, there's a glint in his eye or there's a smile to his face. We're yet to see much of him at the moment. I mean, he's only getting 15, 20 minutes here and there, isn't he? But I must say, he was unlucky against Wigan, wasn't he, with the offside goal. That was him, wasn't it?
I believe so.
And, of course, he did exceptionally well against Burton in the build-up to the own goal, which he quite hilariously tried to claim.
can't blame the guy for trying.
But at the same, yeah, absolutely. But, you know, it was never going to be his goal. Against City, again, we're under the cosh a lot more against an accomplished side. I'd like to see a bit more of him. I'd like to see a bit more in terms of movement, of pace, of general all-round ability of actually holding the ball up and bringing others into play, whereas, you know, he seems to have been a sort of chase the ball kind of player so far. I think that's going to develop. He's shown that he's got a level of technical ability which will only improve. But, you know, he hasn't looked, at the same time, hasn't looked out of place so far.
It's a bit like Shane Long, almost, in that 2005-06 season, where there's something raw about him, and you go, there's something to this guy. But it just wasn't quite all being put together. And you just hope with proper training sessions and working around the team and these cameo appearances that can come along. Because if he does, you know, catch fire and really perform, he's got a bright future.
Yeah, I think so. I wouldn't necessarily say Shane Long. I mean, Shane Long didn't really start showing what he could do until 3 or 4 years later. I'd say very, very, very early on Kevin Doyle as a comparison, where there's an accomplishment there, whereas Shane Long was exceptionally raw. There is an accomplishment there. You can see that he's had a degree of good coaching upbringing. He was from PSG, wasn't
yeah.
he? Kevin Doyle didn't quite have the level of illustrious upbringing, as it were, from Cork City, but had still played first team football in the Irish top division. Doyle showed that there was a level of potency about him.
But by Christmas, he was already almost a very established player.
He was, yes, of course. I say Mate's been out injured. Whereas, say, Kevin Doyle, it took him 4 or 5 appearances before he actually got his first goal. And Mate's actually started showing that he can get in those right positions. He's just been a little bit unfortunate so far. And also, Doyle was, you know, he started the first competitive game of the season, albeit due to injury. But
would you have any hesitation starting him at the moment? If Samuel is, you know, picks up an injury tomorrow, would you have any hesitation starting him? Or would you go for a bit more of an established figure in Joseph Mendes?
I wouldn't have an issue starting him at the moment. Based on what I've seen, I wouldn't have an issue. I think something that we are lacking up front that we clearly indirectly covered so far is physical presence. And he's got that physical presence, whereas Joseph Mendes is much more Dominic Samuel-like, a little bit shorter, it seems. So I'd much prefer having different types of players, but an all-round side, a more balanced side. And I don't think at the moment we quite have that balance in attack right.
No, maybe not quite, but I said it's good. I love...
But we're winning games.
I love getting on that journey with a player early on in their ready career. And it's great when you look at a player and you go, there's something about this guy.
Yeah.
And you just... It's great going on that journey that we've maybe not had so much over the last few, especially with attacking players. We've had a fair few defenders sort of come through the ranks and midfielders. But, I mean, the last sort of young player to come through in an attacking sense is what? Hal Robson-Kanu,
Simon Church.
Yeah.
You know, we certainly over the last few seasons. I mean, the last player to really come through, I'm trying to think now, apart from, you know, before that.
Simon Cox?
You could argue him. I mean, there are a few players out there that have been...
Nathan Tyson?
There's another one, Darius Henderson.
Yeah.
You know, there are a few players out there that have been knocking around the leagues but haven't actually made it at Reading. I'm struggling to think of the last player that actually came through Reading's youth system that actually made it as a striker. You know, Reading, you know, over the last 20 to 30 years and even further back, we've always had a good striker on the books. You know, you go back to Kerry Dixon, Trevor Senior,
Jimmy Quinn, yeah.
Trevor Morley. You know, they were all capable of scoring 20, 25 goals a season. Morley, I think, was easily onto 25 goals in 96, 97 before he did his cruciate. So, you know, you look at those players and you think, you know, but they're not actually, they're obviously crowd favourites, but they're not actually, you know, they haven't been developed by the club, they've been bought in. And there's one thing that I think I've not had as a supporter is a striker who is capable of scoring 20 goals a season and is, to coin a phrase, one of our own.
Yeah, you had it, I suppose, to a slight extent with Archie Lovell, but... He was never... I mean, he got 20 goals in that one season and the following year he got 13-odd.
Yeah, to a degree. I say, but Archie was a decent striker, but I'd never put him in the bracket as a great striker. Yes, the Quinn-Lovell partnership in 93-94, I think it scored 62, 63 goals between them and virtually won the division, you know, single-handedly. As I say, Lovell really came to the fore because of that partnership.
Yeah.
Rather than, you know, being an exceptionally talented player on his own.
Well, fingers crossed, Yakimete can do that. And I suppose the only thing is, just don't get too good too quick, because I want to see you for a couple of years, Yaku, or Yak version 2.0. Anyway, that just about wraps it up. As mentioned, we are still third in the division. We are 7 points already clear of seventh place, which is a staggering stat for this early in the season. What, 18 games in? Still 6 points behind leaders Newcastle, who slipped up at Blackburn. Their pursuit of the 106 points already looking fairly precarious. They've already lost four times, so double the amount Reading lost in that 2005-06, which goes, considering the amount of plaudits that have been put on this Newcastle side already, it just goes to show again how damn good that side was and what a ridiculously phenomenal achievement it was.
I think so. Whenever this discussion comes up, I'm just sat here with a grin on my face. I think Newcastle's primary aim is they don't care about the record. That's not to diminish the record in any way whatsoever, but they don't care about the record. They just want to get back up to the Premier League. But having said that, you know, they've signed £50 million worth of players in the summer for a Championship side is just utterly bonkers.
Not to mention all the amount of money they'd spent on the team. They kept people like Jonjo Shelvey, they've kept as well.
Yeah, and so they've lost three home games. They lost the opening game at Fulham. I mean, they're looking good, but they only need to drop 19 points and our record is safe. And they are currently, I believe, the only club who are really going to actually challenge that record.
That's what made that 2005-06 team good, because not only were they as skillful as, you know, okay, I'd probably argue, in fact, that Newcastle probably got individually some better players in that 2005-06, but what they don't have is that relentless spirit, that drive. Because you can imagine, when you start getting to the spring and if they are 8 or 9 points up, are they really going to bust that gut? I mean, it was a similar story last time they're in a division. They were class above the rest, but they would just slip up occasionally because...
Yeah, they only lost four games that season as well, though, although one of them was away at Scunthorpe, which was quite hilarious. Absolutely. I mean, again, I think they broke the 100-point mark, didn't they? I mean, plenty of clubs have done over the last...
was it?
Something
103?
Like that. Yeah, so plenty of clubs have done that, but they've not, you know, they've not broken 106. Nobody else has, which makes, as I say, makes the record. You're absolutely right about the drive. They'll get up on ability and dedication alone, but they won't get up. They won't beat the record on drive the way they're going at the moment.
We'll move on to news bites very shortly and talk about this takeover speculation. But just quickly, it was funny because when Newcastle were winning games left, right and centre, well, basically before the Blackburn game, a few fans were sort of saying, I actually wouldn't mind the 106-point barrier being broken so that we don't have to put up with the 106-point song. Is it a record you really want us to hang on to for a long time?
Yes. Yes, absolutely.
I think I'm with you.
It's a record that's unique to Reading.
Yeah.
You know,
and 13 wins.
13 wins, yeah. And I still quite like the fact that we held the record for most number of minutes gone without conceding a goal for God knows how many years.
Damn you, Edwin van der Sar.
Well, yeah, exactly.
Still a Football League record for me.
Football League record, yeah. And it was a better record because back in the day when teams were, you know, certainly in Division 4, much of a muchness, they could beat anybody else. You know, whereas Man United were streaks ahead of anybody else when that record was broken.
Yeah, and a keeper, the stature of Steve Death as well, to hold that record
quite
is even more phenomenal.
And the irony being, I believe it was an own goal that ended the record.
Indeed.
That brought it to a close.
Indeed. Right, anyway, that wraps up the recap. We will move on now to, more takeover speculation. Stay tuned.
Reading News Bites on the Tarlhurst End podcast.
Here we are again then, Dave. It seems that not a season goes by when we don't have to deal with takeover speculation. This one, however, unlike a few recent whispers, does seem to have some legs to it. Charles Watts, a Tarlhurst Extra co-host and Get Reading's Reading reporter, has gone very strong on this one, breaking the story. A lot of information being put out the other day from him. I encourage you to go and read that in detail for the full bits and pieces that he's uncovered. Wouldn't like to take credit away from him on this one. But anyway, the bulk of the story is that Reading are in advanced negotiations with a pair from China to buy a majority stake in the club. The pair in question are a brother and sister combo of Dae Yong and Dae Juli. I've probably butchered their name, so I apologise to our new Chinese overlords in advance. I'm sure when we get Charles on the podcast extra, I'm going to be intrigued to see how he pronounces it. Anyway, that's the talk. They are billionaires from China. They own part of a Chinese second division club. They've just been relegated out of the top flight. And they were part of a failed takeover bid at Hull this summer, which apparently broke down because members of their consortium didn't pass or were sort of advised they wouldn't be passing the fit and proper persons test. Now, again, sort of information around that's a little bit murky. Again, it's not sure why or for what. And there's no direct link saying it was those two that caused it to fail. But Dave, at the moment, it's all just a bit... It's still just a bit up in the air. I mean, what was your initial reaction when you first read this story?
Oh dear, to be perfectly honest with you. Everything just seems to be just starting, you know, the Tiger in particular seems to be just starting to build a modicum of trust amongst the Reading faithful. Yes, we knew that they were actively seeking some form of investment. You know, you could read the between the lines as much as you like about, you know, Charles Watts has actually gone on record and said that, that it's Lady Sassamer who will be losing or selling her share. Is it Narin Naritinanun? And,
yeah.
And Tiger will be reducing their stake. Pyroj is now a director.
He was the man that helped broker the initial deal.
Absolutely. So, you know, clearly he's got huge influence over what happens from within the club. Typically, coming from a Chinese nation or communist nation, should I say, there are red flags flying for me.
Oh, dear.
One of them
Boo.
Is that, well, there are red flags flying, or certainly at half mast, that they, you know, they're property developers, which just doesn't sit easily with me. I don't. It just property development and football doesn't.
You've had some bad examples over the years, the likes of Brighton, Wrexham. I'm trying to think of some other examples off the top of my head.
There are York City.
York.
There's another one. Yes, all right. They're not quite as illustrious as anything right at the top end, but they're still property and they're still asset strippers. Not suggesting that these people will be
no.
asset strippers at all, but it's a very, very uncomfortable mix.
But
for
is
me
it,
at
is
the
it
moment.
Any more uncomfortable though than what the Thai owners have done? Because the Thai owners have made it very clear. Well, look at what's happening in Royal Elm Park.
But look at the questions that we asked when the Thai owners first took over, and the mistakes that they've made over the last 2 years. You know, the last 2 years have basically been a complete waste of time, because nobody had up until the beginning of the season, or when Yap Stam took charge. You know, the number of decisions that were being taken but didn't seem to have any long-term emphasis on them, and seemed to just be a little bit kind of haphazard and slapdash, I think is the best way to describe them. And who's to say that these people won't come in and completely rip up what the foundations that Tiger has started to put in place and go their own way. And then on top of that, you've also got, if they do come in before January, invest heavily in January, which could happen. Who's to say that they won't bring in players that are, you know, on a significantly higher wage and completely destroy the dynamic that has started to grow within the club, within the playing staff.
And we
I'm worried. I'm naturally worried.
And I was going to say, on the January front, we've seen exactly that 4 years ago. Or 5 years ago now, around this time of year, someone came in and did exactly that. Anton Zingarevich came in, if you remember, and put up a load of money for Reading to sign players like Jason Roberts. They got in Thomas Sifka. Who else did they get? They got Hayden Mullins.
Mullins, Benicophobia on loan.
Yeah, Hayden Mullins doesn't sound like a big signing, but he was...
Matthew Connolly.
Yeah, but they were on big money at their clubs to be brought in. And you only need to look at the devastation caused by some of the contracts he was handing out. I'm with you. I'm nervous, not in so much as, you know, I know
we've
nothing.
We've been stung. That's
exactly.
Literally it. We've been stung recently. And it looked like it was going to be going a similar way with the Thais until, as I say, Tiger really started
but
to take a handle.
In saying that, though, it's almost like a boat that's sinking, and, you know, because you're in the half of the boat that's not underwater at the moment, you're feeling nice and comfortable. But we've had questions the whole time about what is the financial situation of this club. I mean, you look at the training ground has stalled.
Yes.
Now, that is not the sign of a group that has got cash rich, prepared to invest lots. Just the investment in the summer. Yeah, there was some good contracts handed out, I'm sure. I'm sure people like Liam Moore and Tyler Blackett haven't come cheap, but there still wasn't the sort of massive Derby-esque style investment. So from this point of view, it is a shock and you do go, oh, I'm a bit nervous. But at the same point, without this, were we just going to be in a situation 6 months down the line when those parachute payments ended and if Royal Elm Park wasn't progressing, where we were almost in a worse position? So is this just a case of almost ripping the Band-Aid off early to hopefully move forward?
I think potentially. I mean, let's not beat around the bush. Yes, we have some warning signs, but at the same time, this could also be end up in a really great positive for the club. You know, they could be absolutely perfect for the club in many ways. Certainly with regards to being 75%
owners,
potentially 75% shareholders. The onus is on them to actually, you know, invest money into the club. And let's not forget that money that they put into the club under FFP rules is a gift. It's not similar to what John Madejski did, which he wanted to claw every single penny that he put in back, albeit interest-free and no given timescale. So, you know, it could be absolutely the case that they're great for the club. But if they start signing players on 35 and 40K, you know, a week, contracts, for example, which feasibly Anton Zingarevich did a couple of times, and certainly at championship level, on the likes of Royston Drenthe and other almost no mark players like those, you know, and saddle the club with that rather than actually, you know, backing. You know, there are so many nuances to this that it just.
Well, if they go and sign a load of players on 40 grand a week. If they do what Roman Abramovich and the guys at Man City have done, there's no problem. But like you say, it's if they go and sign... The problem with Anton Zingarevich was it was scattergun. It was, oh, actually, I can only afford about 3 or 4 players on these big deals. Mm-hmm. But, oh, actually, we've kind of got a dressing room that are on half or a third of that.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, obviously, you know, we've been over this time and time again, but it was a recipe for disaster.
Ultimately, if it does all come to fruition, and they do end up majority shareholders at the club, they've got to show the support that they are to be trusted.
Yeah.
They've got to gain the fans on side from the very start with their actions and show that they are, you know, and the way to do that isn't just to pump money at the club. It's to actually show that you're business savvy, show that you've got the long-term interests of the club at heart rather than just lining your own pocket with a bit of development.
Even more importantly, I'd argue, it's to do what Tiger did and engage with fans, be a public face, speak, and then have your actions back up your words. Now, because Anton, again, we go back to Anton Zingarevich, but he was saying all the right things. He was giving interviews. I was a schoolboy. I stood on the terraces at Elm Park. He seemed to tick every box initially under the sun. And it was only, you know... And do you know what? As much as Anton Zingarevich gets a bad press, and I hate what he did to the football club, if he'd had the money, and his dad had continued to give him the money, he would have been almost that perfect owner. Yeah. The problem was that money stopped.
Yeah, let's not forget that he was 23 when he was... The figure out of the club. It's ridiculous. You know, remarkably, I look back to when I was 23, and some of the decisions that I took... You know, you'd need to have an extremely wise head on those shoulders in order to actually pull that off. Ultimately, I think that he was played as a puppet by some of the characters behind the whole TSI takeover, like Chris Samuelson, who was desperate to keep his hands in the pot.
Oh, well, you look at the when they were trying to sell the club, wasn't it? Part of the deal was that they had to keep Samuelson on.
Yes, yeah, something like that. And of course, let's not forget that the club were also paying his company something like 35, 40 grand a month for not doing much. He clearly had his ulterior motives. I think the figure out of the club was obviously was Zingarevich. There were a couple of other shady characters in the background who never really showed their faces, who seem to have got away scot-free. But Zingarevich's name is unfortunately synonymous with financial ridicule at the club.
Yeah, and as I said, I'm not, again, for a single second excusing what he did. But I'm saying is, in terms of an actual front, and he was perfect. Yep. And so he spoke a good game. He clearly liked football. He knew football. But unfortunately, as I said, ultimately, I could be in charge of the club. I like football. I like to think I somehow know football. But I haven't got money. Mm-hmm. And so I could have basically run the club the same way as Zingarevich did. Because all Zingarevich ultimately did was put up a couple of million... to sort of show the banks that, oh, I've got money, then borrowed against the parachute payments, and then we are where we are now, where we were desperate to sell, and that's when, thankfully, the Thai owner stepped in. And no matter what happens from this point, or at least on the presumption that they do manage to sell and pass the club on, they have saved the club.
Yes.
And so they, no matter what you think of them, and if you think they've invested not enough or whatever, you still have to owe them a debt of gratitude, because the club was in a very, very, you know,
it was a parlous state.
Well, when you're in a position where you have to sell your star striker just to pay a tax bill, that's when you start to worry.
Yeah, absolutely.
So,
I think what we can surmise is less TSI, more Tiger.
Yeah, exactly. But it's the nature of modern football. As much as I would love to have a Sir John Medeski figure, a local businessman who's got an interest in the club again, I don't know too many billionaires around Reading anymore, because football has moved on past the day when, you know, local boy done good and has a few million in the bank can run your football club.
Mm-hmm.
You've got to have that sort of financial position where you are literally completely happy to write off tens of millions of pounds a year, like a Steve Gibson, like a Peter Coates at Stoke. There are still a couple of those examples. Yeah, but they're a dying breed. Even, you know, the likes of Dave Whelan at Wigan is stepping away.
Mm-hmm.
You just can't do it. And you
did notice that was it Dave Whelan unveiled a Dave Whelan statue outside the Dave Whelan Stadium at the weekend.
It's DW Stadium. Come on. It could be anything, that DW. It could be me. Maybe it's my stadium. That's just the nature of modern football. The amounts of money you need to be, not just invest, but be prepared to write off is ridiculous. So that's why, unfortunately, you have to go increasingly to people abroad, these people that do have billions, and by all accounts, you know, one of these investors is one of the richest women in China. Mm-hmm. So if that's the case, you know, and she has got, you know, if you're a billionaire, losing £5-10 million a year, as seen at Manchester City and with Roman Abramovich, is nothing. But it's when you get people like the Thai owners who are very asset rich and have done very well for themselves, but they're not billionaires and they've not got all that disposable cash, there's unfortunately the time, if you do want to take your club to the next level, you've got to be prepared to let new people in.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Anyway, that does wraps up the news bite section. We do have a few questions on the ownership as well, which we will get to shortly, so stick around for that. No pub chat this week again, it's just the two of us, and we've pretty much done a pub chat just then, so we will move on to the mailbag.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast,
by Reading fans, for Reading fans.
Mailbag time then, and thank you once again to everyone who submitted feedback to @thetarlhurstend on Twitter, thetarlhurstend@gmail.com, and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend. We'll start with Zoran, who says, is Liam Moore the best signing we've made this year? That was a rhetorical question. And can we beat Fulham without him? Now, we didn't touch on that in the recap. Liam Moore picking up his fifth booking of the season. He will miss that trip to Fulham. And Chris Hartley asked exactly the same question. Who do you feel will replace Liam Moore on Saturday? Who is that man to step in? Is it a formation change? Is it just a like-for-like change? Who comes in?
I think what's going to happen, I think we're going to see a formation change. I think we're going to see Paul McShane and Tyler Blackett as the back two, with obviously Gunter and Obita as the fullbacks. I think that's what's going to happen. We're going to play a back four.
Not tempted to play someone like a George Evans? I mean, Joey Vandenberg might come back in, might be fit.
Could be fit, which could work. I just wonder how this formation is going to work away from home. It's going to be an interesting one. It's nice to actually have these options now. You know, whereas before it was very much a case of we know what we're going to be doing. You know, all those people complaining earlier in the season that we didn't have a plan B, and suddenly we're actually discussing a change in formation.
A whole file of facts of
plans.
Yeah,
absolutely. So it's almost a Brendan Rodgers methodology.
Oof.
Interesting. You could have Vandenberg at the back. You could have George Evans as the central one of the three. You could play the back four. You could bring in Jake Cooper. Well, it's an option.
It is.
We are discussing options.
Yeah.
Not saying it's necessarily going to happen.
Bring Stuart Moore into the back line. He's an option.
Yeah, he's not a recognised central defender.
Just go straight like for like swap, more for more. And Sam Nash as well asked a similar question. He said, how much impact will more suspension be, and do you think we'll keep the same formation? I agree with you. I think they will switch. I think you'll see much more of a traditional back four.
Yep.
And then Samuel up. But then what do you do up front? Do you stick just Samuel up front with the Beerens and have McCleary out wide, or
I think you need to this is a problem that we've got that we were discussing earlier. We don't have a lot of holding up ability up there, do we? I think
Samuel Maite combo,
maybe Maybe. Potentially, with you know, with Samuel up there and Mate just behind, you know, as a sort of behind, or sort of alongside, as more of a traditional front two. It's going to be interesting whatever happens, and either way, it's going to be a tough test.
Yeah, we'll come on to the Fulham game in any other business, so we'll stick with the mailbag for the time being. And Hugh asks, when fit again, who of Vandenberg, Swift and Kermigan should come back into the starting 11 and what system you use? So again, another question on system, but out of those three names, I think we'll both agree Swift is an automatic choice to come straight back in.
Yeah, much as I'm loath to pander to Johnny's love, yes, I think so.
But if all three of them were available tomorrow, you know, for the Fulham game on Saturday, would all three come back in?
No, because we won the last two games. I think Swift should do, because he offers so much more in the middle than Roy Behrens. Vandenberg, I think, makes it onto the bench for me. And Kermigan is an option, I think, potentially, if we were playing a front two. I think if you're playing a traditional front two, then you bring him in alongside Samuel. And I think what has really got me thinking recently is just how potentially good that front two pairing could be.
Oh, I mean, he was, you know, we saw a little bit with Brian McDermott trying to play Rackles and Kermigan. Mm-hmm. And there were moments when that partnership was really looking to flourish. And we spoke about it all season, haven't we? He's that player that loves to play the little flick-ons and things like that for a guy running on and behind the defence. Mm-hmm. It's mouth-watering on paper, but whether it would work remains to be seen. Eric, he's talking about the takeover here. He says, difficult not to be nervous after Anton Zingarevich, but could be exciting if we can compete with other championship clubs financially. David, commenting again on the speculation, says, nervous, but if the Ties want/need to sell, then we'll have to hope new owners are just as good. Royal Ginger, why have our Thai overlords forsaken us? Did we displease them? Who would make an appropriate sacrifice to appease them? For legal reasons, I don't feel I'm capable of answering this question. Dave?
Staying silent.
I'm sure people are shouting various names at the radio right now. so we'll leave that one there, Royal Ginger. So again, very similar things to what we brought up in the news bites. Dave, really, lots of nervousness around. It's the whole change. I mean, you don't, especially when you're third in the league, you don't like change. I mean, I think this would be a different situation if this speculation had happened at the end of last season, when you've just finished 17th in the table, the team's in disarray. I think people would generally be a lot more excited. But now you're third in the league, team's flying, everything's coming together. Suddenly it's like, oh God, do we need to rock the boat?
Yeah, exactly. And that's exactly where I'm coming from. You know, we're doing exceptionally well so far this season, all things considered. Suddenly this news comes out of the blue, and it's just a little bit concerning, based on, you know, what occurred before.
Indeed. Steve Bennett, he's not happy. He says, not happy that this is coming so soon after the Thai takeover and halfway through a so far successful season. This has the potential to disrupt what we're building, unsettle Yapstam, make January window signings impossible. Who's going to sign for a club that's under a takeover bid? Worrying times, in my opinion. And that's before we even look at the fact that new bidders have failed FFP tests before. End rant. Excellent results recently, though. Again, on the FFP front, there's no direct evidence. I don't think the Premier League have even commented on who, but again,
it was by all accounts, it was someone within the consortium, that were attempting to take over. But let's not forget. I'm led to understand, based on what I've read from Charles and various other media sources, that it's just basically these two people coming on board with the
These weren't the two that directly failed FFP.
No, these two were absolutely fine. It was just one of the consortium members.
Yeah, and even if you look at the Thai consortium, there was. I mean, there's been speculation about why one man didn't take his 25% share.
Yes, now we know.
For similar reasons, exactly. Yeah. So, it is risky. And again, it could disrupt things. I mean, Yap might have been, you know, told certain things by Tiger, and this could disrupt it. But I think what's encouraging is the fact that, as we mentioned earlier, Tiger would stay on board. This doesn't seem to me like a hit-and-run job, where they're just going to scarper off with the rights to Royal Elm Park and go away. It seems, I genuinely believe, and again, I might have just been taken in by him, but I really hope that the impression I got from him in that meeting we went to, Dave, was genuine. But I got the impression this was a guy that had got the bug.
Yes, quite.
That really cared about this club.
And yeah, I think so. Why would you go into so much effort to put some foundations in place and not see it through? That's the question you ask. You know, the guy has actually gone out on a limb to actually take control of what's going on, with or without the consent of the other two shareholders. But he's the guy that is the figurehead now. He's the guy who's actually putting his face literally in the stand, and on, you know, and when it suits, and you know, in the director's box. I don't get why you would do that. Take control and then suddenly just relinquish all control, you know, after all your hard work. So I think he's going to stay on, and he's presumably going to stay on as the primary advisor to.
And he said as much, you know, and he said in interviews and stuff that they're only going to look for investment if it is people that share their values. Yeah. They're not just going to take anyone into their group. And again, you have to give people the benefit of the doubt. You have to give them that trust. And until they give you a reason not to trust them, so far, the Ties have done what they've promised to do.
Exactly. And he'd gone on record, didn't he? He actually, you know, within the meeting that we went to,
he
explicitly stated that they had actually turned down investment opportunities because the people who were looking to invest, they weren't of the same morality. They weren't of the same mentality.
They didn't share common goals.
No, exactly. They didn't have the club at the best interests of the club at heart.
Yeah. So think again. It is a potential. You're right. It's a potentially very exciting thing. I mean, look at. I imagine there was this trepidation when City got taken over, when Chelsea got taken over, when Leicester got taken over. But it could be brilliant. We've just got to cross our fingers, hope that this deal's been done for the right reasons with the right people. And ultimately, I don't like to say we're powerless because, you know, fans look at teams like AFC Wimbledon and great stories like that. But ultimately, you've just got to strap yourself in and see what happens and then react to
hopefully
anything.
Hopefully the ride don't come off the tracks.
Indeed. Right. So moving on. And Ian Phillips just finally on the takeover front says, I was going to ask, after all the doubt, me included, have the Ties done enough to convince they know what they're doing?
If you'd have asked me that 6 months ago, I'd have said no.
Yeah,
not
agree.
A chance. But as we just mentioned some minutes ago, that Tiger has very much taken control, taken hold of the handlebars, and is very much directing this this. Say we're talking handlebars, I might as well say bike, I suppose, hadn't I? Guiding this bike through what could have been troubled waters, but now seems to be, I don't know, how to ride a bike through troubled waters.
I was about to say, I don't. If you're taking your bike through water, you've probably got it wrong.
Yeah, you're taking the wrong turn in somewhere, yeah. So you get what I'm saying. He's taken the mantle, and he's... You know, he's the guy that's taken all the bullets.
He's given you reason to feel comfortable. And said all along, until I've been given a reason to not trust these guys, and so far, not had that reason, you've just got to, again, cross your fingers, hope they're doing what they say they're doing, and that all will turn out going. And ultimately, there's a long way to go in this. Just because you're in advanced negotiations doesn't mean this is going to happen. We've seen takeover, you know, when Zingarevich or what was left of his consortium was selling the club. How many different rumours did we have then? So this could all fall apart. We could be back to square one. So watch this space. Again, credit to Charles for getting to the bottom of the story. And I very much encourage you to go over to getreading.co.uk to read more of that. Charles will no doubt be web chatting this week. And hopefully I'll be speaking to him on the podcast extra on Friday. Apologies that there was no show last week. Charles took a day off late notice. So unfortunately, again, Friday is our only real window to do the show and he wasn't available. So fingers crossed we'll get back on track with that. A couple of final points, starting with George Dupree and something completely different from the takeover. He says, should Reading subsidise our away tickets down to £20 instead of doing it for visiting clubs? £36 for Leeds is a joke.
I think he's got a fair argument there, and I wish we'd had that question over a week ago, because it's one of the points that I could have raised at the focus group that was held at the club on Thursday. There is an article coming out, by the way, where you'll be able to read all about it.
Excellent.
It's a fair point. Absolutely, it's a fair point. I don't think there's anything wrong with sort of trailblazing in the championship and offering away fans £20 tickets. I mean, obviously, like-for-like accommodation, the club had no choice then but to offer £20 tickets in the Eamon Dolan stand. But it would have been nice for the club to actually turn around and certainly look to subsidise our away tickets potentially on the back of that as well, rather than looking for reciprocal agreements. But of course, you know, if a club does that, that costs money. That's got to be found somewhere. There's always, you know, for every, you know, every give, there's got to be some take. That's certainly
the
point that the club will look at.
That if you have, say, £35 away tickets to subsidise your £20 travel, you know, if you don't get those away fans through the door, then you haven't got the money to subsidise your own tickets.
Mm-hmm.
Look, I think £36 for a game of Championship football is ridiculous. I cannot possibly understand why Leeds have done it, but look, that's Leeds, that's Massimo Cellino.
They're not the only club to do it, though,
no,
are they?
Ipswich, Ipswich charged over £30.
Norwich did do the same. And it's just, yeah. I mean, Ipswich and Norwich have always been fairly high. I mean, I remember when I went to Ipswich in 96 and it was £14. And that was, you know, when you consider that Elm Park was I think that season, 96-97, was £8. You know, to have to pay £6 more just because you got a seat at a you know, fairly nicer ground, it's got to be said. You know, they were certainly higher than the majority, if not all, of the clubs in that division. I also remember going to Southend that same season. They were £12 no concessions. So, you know, I was a 15-year-old and expecting to get in for like £7 and £6-7, however much it was. And
there
then,
went your pie and programme.
Quite, yeah. So I paid the same as my uncle and aunt, £36 for three people to go and watch a match of football and see us lose 2-1 and take the lead.
Ultimately, it's what you said. The money's got to come from somewhere. And with the state that Reading are in financially, you know, what we've just been talking about, they can't necessarily afford to do that. Now, with the Premier League, I think they've got no excuse whatsoever given the amount of money that's coming in through the door. We talked about it in the interview with Adam and Mark. At Championship level, gate money is very important. Mm-hmm. It forms a much bigger part of your income than it does in the Premier League.
Isn't it about 60%?
It's something along those lines, but I read a statistic that said that the rise in the most recent round of Premier League TV rights, so the increase all the clubs got, could have subsidised every seat in the stadium for a season, given that rise.
Mm-hmm.
But and while credit to some clubs like West Ham did lower their prices, and I think a couple of other clubs have done the same, not a lot have. So, yeah, I don't know what can be done. Hopefully, teams like Leeds, Ipswich, Norwich see the light, and they go for 20s plenty. It's a very good campaign. Credit to the Football Supporters Federation for sticking to it, and Reading should be very much applauded for... And again, it's the noble thing to do. Ultimately, okay, we as away fans might not see the benefit of it, but we can take pride that our club is sticking to it.
Yep.
And I think that is something that, again, you know, it's great to be able to take pride in your club like that, to be able to go to an away fan and say, well, look, you know, my club only charges you £20 to come here. And other fans have given Reading plenty of praise for that. It would be a shame to lose that, you know, lose that goodwill. And it doesn't really set a good example either.
Mm-hmm. I think potentially, I mean, maybe reaching out a little bit of a long shot here. I think potentially you could look at that £36 for Leeds and £35 for Norwich and wherever, and actually use that and say, you know, use that as on the playing surface, as it were, and you know, say to the players, we paid £36 for this. It's nearly double what we would pay at home. What this lot paid at home. You know, we paid £36. Go and put us a performance in, and hopefully they do that. So might be reaching out for a little bit of a long shot, but players might actually take a look at that and think, well, actually, let's do it for the fans who have paid, you know, a ridiculous amount of money.
Yeah, well, I think they do it anyway. But yeah, if anything that gives them a bit of an extra boost is great. And ultimately, if the club did subsidise our away tickets, you're still putting £36 in Leeds' pocket.
Yes.
So Reading would be directly funding a Championship rival.
Yeah.
Which ultimately is not anything any business wants to do. So, so it's a nice idea anyway, and thanks for the suggestion, George. And we had another question from Reading Fan Abroad as well. He was talking about the way away tickets are allocated, Dave. And he was sort of saying, why is it, and I don't know if you know this, you are a very frequent away traveller, why is it that you can't pick your seat away from home?
Well, a frequent away traveller that hasn't actually been to an away game this season.
A former frequent. a lapsed frequent traveller.
Yeah. Finances and all that. Yes, I have travelled away significantly in the past. sometimes you get away clubs who actually dictate to Reading Football Club how they wish for their tickets to be sold. So, for example, Everton always ask for the lower tier tickets to be sold before they start going into the upper tier. Now, Reading have never sold enough tickets at Everton for Everton to open the upper tier. And I believe, let's say there are two different sort of sections within the Everton away end. Within the you've got in the lower Bullens, you've got the paddock and the slightly nicer seats with the great big poles in the way towards the back. Sometimes it's just literally luck of the draw. Sometimes it's unreserved seating. Like Barnsley, I believe, is unreserved seating. Now, the problem with unreserved seating is that if you do offer that, then you lose 10% of the capacity. That's literally just the way it is. It's Football League regulations, or maybe FA regulations, one of the two anyway. There's a whole raft of reasons why, you know, certain clubs sell their tickets the way they do. As I say, Everton is the obvious one. But if you get a club like Arsenal, I believe that their tickets were all in one sort of one very, very, very long bundle of tickets. It's literally just taken, take the first one. And it literally fills up from one side all the way across.
Well, hopefully, I mean, something, because you'd like to think that if they can do home ticketing with pick your seat, they can do it for away. And we've said to RSC Fan Abroad, and Adam said it very much in the interview we did a couple of weeks ago, and I know he's done as much, if you've got questions like that or you've got suggestions, they really want to hear them. Send them to that customer services email.
We live in the just interrupting there. Just thinking literally off the top of my head, it wouldn't be that far fetched potentially for somebody to design a software system that integrated the different stadia around the country and actually have it linked to each club, so that when they sell an away ticket, you can pick your own seat. You know, when you say, I want to go to, Leeds, for example, and I say, I want to pick my own seat in the away stand and actually sit in that particular area of the, you know.
There you go, Tarlhurst End entrepreneurs. There's your challenge. Make your fortune. And don't forget who suggested it for when you make your millions. Patreon.com/Tarlhurst End. And Dave, what's your address?
I'll take my cut.
What's your bank details? It's a podcast. Don't worry. No one will use them badly. Anyway, that does wrap up the mailbag. Thank you once again for all the questions at the Tarlhurst End on Twitter, thetarlhurstend@gmail.com, facebook.com/Tarlhurst End. Yes, we did have a question from Hoop saying, can you discuss the merits of 3-5-2 over 4-3-3?
Yeah, you've got to ask that, because that's the one I've been putting most bleeding thought into.
Can we save it, though, for next week?
Oh, she must. Actually, let's do that for pub chat.
We can do pub chat, because we'll get Johnny back in, and it's one of those sort of things where...
What does he know?
He doesn't know very much. Anyway, sorry, Hoops. We will get to you next week.
We'll give you a proper answer. We'll actually dedicate a whole section to it.
Exactly. There you go. You can't ask more than that. Anyway, let's roll on. We've got that Fulham game to look forward to in Any Other Business.
The Tarlhurst End Podcast. Any Other Business.
Trip to Craven Cottage down at the weekend. Dave, Fulham, they're not doing too badly this season. 10th in the table. They lost last week. They've not been in the greatest of runs. 3 wins since August. And the bookies make the only narrow favourites. They're just above evens. The draw's 12-5, Reading 5-2. The battle of the two possession leaders in the Championship as well. So should see a lot of retention of the ball. Reading have got an average of 58.9% and Fulham 56.7%. What do you make of Fulham at the moment? Because they're a really strange side that they pull off this brilliant result, like, you know, beat Newcastle, and they just go and just capitulate at home.
They're very, very strange. You watch them against Newcastle, and they were worthy of their win. I thought, in many ways, I think they restricted Newcastle to one real chance. And I say 1-1-0. Was it Matt Smith with the goal, wasn't it? But then they go and lose some silly games, and then they'll go and beat Huddersfield 5-0.
Yeah.
And they'll go and absolutely wipe the floor with the Brentford side, an incredibly good Brentford side that wiped the floor with us and wiped the floor with QPR. You know, and thoroughly deserved the win at Griffin Park. Just very, very strange. Why are they doing winning 3 games since August? And yet the games that they've won have been exceptional. They're a dangerous side. They are a very dangerous side. They know where the back of the net is. You know, still,
Chris Martin is one of the championships, still for me, one of the championship's best strikers.
I'd agree with that. Absolutely, I'd agree with that. You know, they've still got potency. They've got a very tactically astute manager in Slavisa Jokanović. They're a weird side because they're a very talented side. They know how to attack. They know how to take teams apart. We've really got to be on our game if we're going to get anything from this game.
Yeah, and Lucas Pearson, again, coming back to haunt us. And I couldn't go amiss without mentioning, of course, this unfortunately was pretty much where you can point to the wheels falling off last season.
Yes.
2-0 up and everything looking rosy and 4-2.
Yeah, I still remember writing the tweet after Sarr put us 2-0 up, that's the way Orlando Sarr, I like it. And then by the time I'd actually written that and sent it, I think it was 2-2. Was it Steve Clarke actually admitted after that day, on the end of that game, that he didn't think he got the balance of defence and attack right? It was just after we'd lost Tish Boller for a significant period of time, wasn't it?
He might have even got injured. He played in that game. I don't know if he got injured in that game.
I'm not sure he played in it because I think that was the struggle then from that point forward. Once Tish Boller was injured, was to, as I say, get that balance, and we didn't get it. We didn't have that battler in midfield, that dynamic and big presence in midfield. We have plenty of tippy tappy players. But eventually Fulham just waltzed in between the lines and exposed us four times.
Well, money where your mouth is, time. Prediction league wise, you got it spot on against Bristol City. You picked up three vital points that moves you. Unfortunately, you're still technically bottom alongside me. We're both on 16 points. Johnny got the correct score as well. He's up to 21. He's on top of the table. Charles Watts on 20. And Westie's on 17. So still very tight. Five.
Johnny's on a bit of a roll. He's got
Johnny's on a massive roll. Well, the thing is, I'm on a roll as well. I think
five
I've
correct results from eight he's got.
I've got about eight results of the game in a row, but I've only got the score right once. So I just keep picking up one point. I'm just biding my time here. I'm not feast or famine. It's very consistent. So 5 points between the top and bottom of us. Given that you are on a roll with a win, how do you see this one going?
I'm going to go 1-1. It's a jackpot draw.
I'm going to go for an optimistic 1-0 away win. And I will, of course, get predictions from Johnny, Charles and Westie in the week. And I said, hopefully I'll be sitting down with Charles on the Podcast Extra a little later this week. Just a couple of plugs, things up on the website. Very much encourage you, if you've not yet listened to that interview I did with Adam Benson and Mark Bradley, go check that out. We're hopefully going to get another one in the next few weeks. I don't want to say who it is now in case it doesn't come off. But hopefully we'll get another one. Big thank you to the Football Club for opening up and giving us a really good interview. And if you've not checked that out, I encourage you to do so. There's also a written version as well for the highlights if you don't want to listen to the whole thing. Credit as well also to Star. I went to the fans forum with Gareth McCleary and Paul McShane last night. Usual rules apply. What's said in the room stays in the room. But I can say both players were great. They answered every question that was thrown at them. Some slightly stranger than other questions, but they're good nights and Star do some good work. We also had the Reading FC Deaf team in and some people from the Community Trust talking about the work they do, and it's great to be reminded of the work that goes on around the football club. You know, we've just spent an hour and 20 minutes talking about the first team and events around that, but you forget sometimes that there's a much wider club element to Reading, and they do some fantastic work out in the community. And hopefully, again, we might get a chance to speak to them some point down the road. And again, credit to staff putting on the event. There's a good little turnout. But I've got to say, not as big a turnout as I'd hoped. And, well, not hoping, you know, as many people as want to turn up is fine. But if you are someone out there and you've always thought, oh, I've got a question, I want to ask something, or you've read an interview with a player going, oh, they're not really asked the tough questions, go along to these things. Dave, you've been to quite a few in the past, mm-hmm. and you can back me up here. They give you answers in a candid way, in a honest, down-to-earth, one-to-one way that you just do not get in any media setting.
No, absolutely. I think, obviously, you know, the whole... What happens in the room stays in the room.
Chatham House rules, is it?
Chatham House rules, pretty much. Yeah, no reporting and what have you. That goes a long way to allowing the players to open up, and obviously the manager as well, as and when, and various other club staff as and when they actually make an appearance. at these events. Yeah, they're generally very, very good, and certainly enlightening, particularly if you get a particularly deep and meaningful question that you get a candid and honest answer from, which has happened in the past. And yeah, sometimes you even get a bit of emotion thrown in as well.
Indeed, and people say, oh, well, I don't want to pay the star joining fee. But again, we were reminded last night that that fee doesn't just go to coach travel and things like that. It does go to, you know, they sponsor the deaf team. And it goes for community projects like that. So get involved. And if you've got any questions, I'm sure they'll be more than happy to answer them for you. And again, the Community Trust were keen to point out about the Golden Gamble. You know, people sometimes think that the Golden Gamble is something run by the club to get the club money. It's not. It goes to the Community Trust. What doesn't go into the prize fund goes to them. So again, it goes to support projects in the community. So they were saying, you know, if you have got that spare pound and you want to help out, you know, the wider community around the football club, go and buy yourself a Golden Gamble ticket and you stand a chance of winning money yourself. Hashtag gamble away.
I haven't yet, but I've played it every single time ever since, pretty much ever since it began.
I was
closest I came was one out.
I've been three out.
Yeah.
I've never known, have you known anyone that's won it though? As in directly?
Yes, I believe, it's a couple of acquaintances of mine have, if not them, then their family.
Did they buy you a pint with it?
No, because I didn't know them at that point in time. And in fact, actually, if I do recall that a couple of pre-season friendlies in 1997, I think it was Bournemouth and Chelsea or Southampton, one of the two, and the same bloke won it.
Unbelievable. I think my dad always tells the story of he let someone go in front of him against Port Vale, I think, and the guy that went in front of him won it.
Won it, yeah.
So, oh well. Yeah. Could have been his embellishment.
If anybody's wondering, it was Brighton at home on Boxing Day 2011, 3-0 win that I was 1-0.
Oh dear. A date that will
live. Bumper, £1,200.
A day that shall live in infamy. Anyway.
Until I win.
Indeed. And don't you worry, we'll be hearing about that on this show when you do.
Every bleeding week.
Indeed. Right. Anyway, that does wrap up the show. Thank you very much to everyone who has downloaded and listened as always. We've had some nice bits of feedback as well.
Can I just say gamble away?
Gamble away indeed. Yeah, wouldn't be a show without it. We've had some really nice comments and bits of feedback about not just the interview and stuff. And again, I mentioned at the top of the show and I go on about it, the Patreon campaign. It just gives you that warm, nice, fuzzy feeling when people give a couple of quid over to help support the website as well, and you guys are brilliant. But anyone that listens and downloads and stuff is great. So you're all supporters here. So thank you. Anyway, that is the show this week. We will be back hopefully next week with a full complement of the three of us. Johnny should be back, and as I said, I'll be with Charles on Friday. Fingers crossed. In the meantime, go on, you guys.
Social with the boys.
Find them on Twitter
@thetarlhurstend
and facebook.com/thetarlhurstend.